This is the Bottom Line Podcast, and I'm your host, Ben Rogers. Today's date is Friday, November 16th, 2018, and this is episode number 27. The Bottom Line is a podcast that links lessons learned from sports, business, and life, and its goal is to highlight stories from the front line, from small business owners, coaches, and others that are currently on the path to their own definition of success, while the average competition sits on the bench. After the last recording, I received a phone call from a man named Mike Morris, who related perfectly to what this podcast is all about. We went for coffee, and we could have talked for hours about how our experiences with teams and lessons learned from coaches have shaped our lives. Mike went on to tell me about a coach that influenced his life in more ways than he could count, and he told me that I'm making a big mistake if I don't get him in for an interview. So that brings me to today's guest, a recommendation of Mike's. His name is Coach Dave Savino. Coach Savino is currently the head baseball coach at Glen Allen High School outside of Richmond, Virginia, and although his love for the game of baseball is evident, the ways in which he impacts others goes way beyond the baseball field. A quick reminder for listeners to please share this podcast with your average friend you think could find some benefit. You can share by text, email, and your social media platforms. I greatly appreciate your support. All right, let's jump right into the thick of this thing with Coach Savino. I took it upon myself to reach out to some folks that know Coach Savino, and one of his assistant coaches told me, quote, "You know, Dave is as legendary in the classroom as he is on the diamond. He once told me that he had a professor in college that made history come alive in class. It had inspired Dave to become a teacher and use those methods in his own classroom. Through his lectures, that professor made things matter, made them relevant to his audience, and I see Dave's desire to reach his own audience in the same fashion," end quote. With that introduction aside, Coach Savino, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ben. I'm happy to be here.
Do you have any idea who said that about you, if you had to guess?
Matt Dowell.
That'd be one of our mutual connections. That's absolutely correct. Yeah, he's a big fan. We'll get him maybe another question from him here later on. But let's start with just a quick bio from you, on you. Hear about kind of where you're from, how you got into coaching, teaching, what you do now, all that kind of stuff.
Okay. I'm from New York, Long Island boy. Basically, my childhood was kind of a scene out of the movie Sandlot. We had a field at the end of our road, and we all went down there. We spent every day, all day, down at the field. It wasn't a baseball field. It was a field under some high tension wires, and we kind of fashioned it as best we could into a baseball field, and that's what we did. We threw up the ball and we hit it. There was no pitching. We tried to hit home runs, and we spent our entire summers there.
So you've been a baseball guy your entire life,
yes,
is that right?
And that came from my dad.
Right.
My dad was a player. He was a huge Yankees fan. If you weren't a Yankees fan in our family, you got disowned. So
I was wearing a Red Sox sweatshirt when you came in.
I almost turned around and walked right back out when I saw that. But actually, I was I'm very proud of what the Red Sox did this year because of how much they were a team.
Right.
But anyway, finally Little League began, and they started actually pitching at us, which was different. And in my first Little League at bat, I hit a home run.
That's amazing.
Well, I hit the ball, and there were five or six errant throws,
sure,
that led to me scoring. But when I came into the dugout, one of the kids who I didn't know walked up to me and said, "Man, are you a professional?" And at that moment, I was sold on baseball.
Right.
I thought, hey, this is great. I don't think I got a hit the rest of the season, but
that one kept you coming back.
I was locked in at that point. When I got to high school, I met probably the coach that changed my life, Coach Bill Batewell. He was my JV football coach and JV baseball coach. Huge man, ex-Marine, tough guy, chewed tobacco. Didn't matter what the weather was, and in New York it can get very cold at the end of football season and very cold at the beginning of the baseball season, but he always wore a pair of shorts and the thinnest little windbreaker you ever saw, so we could never complain about, we were all bundled up, we could never complain about the weather because Coach Batewell was always, and I think he did that on purpose.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But he had all these great sayings, and he was tough on us in football. If you did something wrong, he would tell you, meet me in the wrestling room after practice. And you came in with your pads on and your helmet on, and he physically beat you. This was old school.
There's no way to sugarcoat that.
No. But it was, we didn't know any better. And this was old school, and it was fine. And we loved him because even though he was rough around the edges like that, we knew he cared for, you know, mm-hmm, he cared about us.
Right. anyway, this was high school?
This was high school, okay. Yeah. And he coached me in baseball and in football. After high school, I knew I wanted to continue playing baseball. And so myself and two of my teammates headed south because we wanted to play in the south. And we went to a place called Madison College, which was just flipping over from an all-girls school, a teaching college, to accepting males. And they were just starting new sports programs, so we thought maybe we could play. So we came down to Harrisonburg, fell in love with the school immediately. I wasn't very good. I had a cup of coffee with the team, but nothing more than that. I had a future major leaguer playing ahead of me, which didn't have anything to do with anything. I wasn't going to play anyway. But and no one told us that Harrisonburg can be as cold as New York, right, especially in that valley with that wind. But I had a great time at Madison. It's a wonderful school. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say a bad word about JMU. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. And one of my friends, one of the guys I came down to New York with, said that he was going to teach and coach, and I thought, well, maybe I can do that. So I went back for another year to JMU to get my student teaching and my education classes. And I thought, I'll teach in Northern Virginia or Virginia Beach. That's where all my JMU friends were, so that's where I'll go. And the last day that I was at school before I was going home to New York, I ran into this guy, one of those guys that you just kind of know. And he said, what are you going to do? I told him. He asked me, where are you going to do it? I told him. He said, why don't you teach where I live? And I said, where do you live? And he said, Henrico County. I said, what's that? Right. And that was it. And he left. I don't think I ever saw him again in my life. So I go back home, no computers in those days. And I open the encyclopedia up, and there is the map of Virginia. And I'm writing letters off to Northern Virginia schools and Virginia Beach schools. And I see that Henrico thing. And I said, well, it's just one more stamp. I'll send them a letter too. Only locality I heard from was Henrico.
No way.
Yeah, they call me late August, and they're frantic. They need a football coach at this place called Hermitage High School. Can you coach football? Absolutely. I'll coach, you know, anything.
Whatever,
to get
right.
A job. So I go down for the interview. They hire me on the spot, not because I'm impressive, but because I can fill that.
They needed
that
a body.
Bucket. Yeah,
right.
They did. They needed a warm body. So I coach football. I was probably the worst football coach in the history of football. And then at the end of the year, I volunteered to help the JV baseball coach. And I think they desperately wanted to get me out of football, but they didn't want to come out and fire me, so they got creative, and the principal called me in at the end of the year and said, Savino, you can either continue coaching football or you can have the JV program, because the head coach for the JV was going to this new school.
Knowing that you probably wanted to coach
baseball.
Absolutely.
They knew exactly. So it took me 2 seconds to say baseball, and they were able to ease me out of football without coming out and firing me.
You knew what was going on.
I knew what was going on, yes. And that was fine with me. I liked football, but I'm not really a football guy. I'm more a baseball guy. So I did JV for about 6 years. Got the varsity job in, I think, 1987. And did that for 20 years. And then I stopped for 7 years. I got out of baseball. I had a little girl. I did this late in life. And we moved to Glen Allen. And so that's what I did for 7 years. And I thought my coaching career was over. I didn't expect to ever go back to it. Even though it never gets out of your blood, I just thought this was it. And then I'm at the pool one day, and one of my ex-players is there. It's just a fortuitous thing. And he told me that his son went to this new high school, Glen Allen, just graduated, played ball, and he said, the coach is leaving. And I don't know why I thought, you know, maybe, you know, I should interview for this, but right. I went to my wife. She was supportive, as always, said, go for it, and got the job. And so I'm in my sixth year now at Glen Allen.
So it was 87 to 2007?
2006.
2006, yeah. And then you started at Glen Allen in
2014,
right. Got it. And when you were at Hermitage, any types of state championships, players went on the majors, anything like that?
We had a couple of guys go. I never had a player going to the major leagues. I've had some guys go minor leagues, get drafted, and so forth.
I actually really like hearing that, because I think it was Coach Lewis who mentioned something similar. He's like, look, we've never had these these big-time Major League Baseball players, but we've been able to find success by continuing to do the little things right,
right.
with, I don't want to say average players, but non-Major Leaguers, right?
Right.
So, no, that's cool. I wrote down something. When you were talking, it was Bill Batewell. Is that your,
yes.
your coach? Gotcha. You mentioned that he had a lot of cool sayings, right, or things that kind of stuck with you.
Right.
What if you could think of one or two things that he said that still sticks with you today that maybe you use with your teams, what would you say it is?
They weren't necessarily quotes, but just little things that he said that we had no clue where the, we'd never heard these things before. You know, he'd look at us if we were doing something wrong, and he would say, 86 that. That meant whatever you're doing, stop it. Grab a hat, which meant, you know, let's get going. Let's,
right.
let's leave. If he got really upset with us, he would scream at us and he would say, Judas Priest. And if you come out onto my field today, every once in a while, if I get upset with the way things are going in practice or something, I'll yell. And of course, the kids have no idea. Some of them know that was a heavy metal band, but that was,
right.
you know, he was saying these things long before that uh-huh. even existed. Ducks on a pond, can of corn, all these baseball sayings that we had never heard before, we all started saying them, we all started emulating them, and I say them to this day. It's, mm-hmm. you know, things that he did, I was watching him intently without even knowing it, and, you know, emulating and imitating.
Sure.
Him.
Yeah. I think that's the definition of a good coach, right? When you get somebody else to kind of act and follow you based on that. Is he still living today?
He is still living, and after I left Hermitage, he became the varsity coach and became a legend on Long Island.
Really?
He won championships, won hundreds of games. And actually, I found out recently that he retired from Station High School, where I went, and now he's coaching another high school, which I didn't think he's, I mean, I can't, I don't even know how old he is, but whoever has him is lucky to have him.
Right.
Yeah.
When you went to, I think I read, and I apologize for not knowing enough about it, was it your first or second year in Glen Allen you won a state championship?
Second year.
That's amazing. You're out of baseball for 7 years, mm-hmm. and you come right back into it.
Right.
And won a state championship 2 years. That's pretty amazing. Obviously, I know you know, came with plenty of years of hard work and a lot of credit to assistant coaches and players and things like that. But that actually brings me to just knowing that, you know, kind of your second year back into it. Now you coach for plenty of years, but after maybe a hiatus. What I did here for today's kind of the questions for you is I reached out to what I refer to as the bottom line army. What that is, past guests, fans of the show, people that want to ask a question, things like that. And one of my accountability partners who was my high school strength coach, his name is Jake Just, younger brother of Josh Just, the head coach, kind of still my accountability partner today. All those kinds of things. One of the questions he had I thought was really interesting that kind of applies to that situation with the fact that you kind of got back into it so quickly. He said, what's the one thing that you would tell a first-year coach he or she needs to establish in season one? Maybe that one non-negotiable that you need to get there and establish right away.
Without a doubt, your culture. You have to do that immediately. I didn't do that my first year back. I'd been out for 7 years, and I was kind of feeling my way. Even though I had coached for so long, I was kind of feeling my way in 2014. And at the end of the year, I was not satisfied at all with the coaching job that I did. And in my second year, I decided, and it was just Matt and I. I like a small staff. I don't like having, you know, seven coaches mm-hmm. on a baseball team. And Matt and I established this culture called the Pack. I got it from Matt Deggs, who's the head coach at Sam Houston State. The Pack is this idea of a brotherhood. It's the idea of a team, and you are subservient to the team. You are there to serve the team. You know, if a kid says, hey, coach, I'm a great player. No, you're only a great player if you lift or elevate the players around you to as close to your level as you can. Otherwise, you are not a great player because you're not a pack
right.
guy. You're not one of our guys. So, and this isn't something that we talk about in preseason and then never talk about again. We talk about pack all the time. We do pack things together all of the time. They take a pride. And once you're a member of the pack, you're always a member of the pack. We live in a culture today, in a society today, where the individual is glorified. And in baseball, what has developed are these showcase teams and these travel teams, and they have their place. As a matter of fact, they're important now because that's how you get in front of college coaches. And I hate to say this because I'm a high school coach, but you don't need to play high school baseball anymore. If you play for showcase and travel, you don't even need it. So how do we make high school baseball unique? How do we make it special? What we tell the guys is when they come in is that what you're playing for here, and I'm going to ask you to go against human nature because human nature, especially for 16, 17-year-olds, human nature is to, I want to walk around school, be the big man on campus, and I want to be the guy. You have to give that over, give your stats over to the team, to the pack. I'm going to ask you to do that. It's not going to be easy to do. You're going to slip back into showcase mode from time to time, but that's what we're going to demand here at Glen Allen. That's what you need to do. So the pack mentality, everything is filtered through the pack. Nothing is more important than the pack. I don't care how good a player you are. If you aren't part of the pack, then you're not going to be in this program. In showcase ball, guys go out and they showcase themselves. They're out there for the radar gun. They're out there in front of college coaches. And some of them go out there, they throw three innings, and then they leave. They don't have any idea what their team did, if they won or lost. It doesn't matter. But at Glen Allen and in high school ball, you're playing for your community. You're playing for your school. You're playing for your family. And you're playing for this brotherhood, guys that you grew up with in the same neighborhoods. And you're playing for a legacy. We hope that our players feel more pressure living up to the legacy. And Glen Allen hasn't been around very long as a high school, but we've been successful enough that we've built up a little bit of a legacy. We want the kids to feel some pressure. How am I going to fill out this black and teal jersey? How am I going to do that? Am I going to be as good as those guys in the past? I don't want to be on the first team that doesn't do as well as those other teams. And we tell them that what you're doing is for history. When you play travel ball, those results are gone with the wind. But if you do something special here, there's going to be a banner that goes up inside the gym.
Right.
And when you're in 20 years from now, you can bring your son or your daughter into that gym and point at that banner and say, I was part of that. I did that. This is unique. This is special. And if you can get the guys to buy into that, then you've got something unique and special.
Sure. So it's establishing the culture, and for you, it's all about the pack mentality.
Absolutely.
Right. And so you had mentioned you kind of giving over your stats, right? Like that, those things don't matter anymore.
Right.
If I'm a freshman on your team, and my challenge is, and your challenge as a coach to me is to become a member of the pack. What's the first thing that goes through my head, or what's the first thing you're coaching me to do? Is it just simply selflessness?
Well, we explain what the whole pack mentality is. Then we take them into our home dugout. In our home dugout, what I ask seniors to do, and I'll ask four or five seniors, I don't ask everybody to do this, after they graduate and go off to college, and I just did this a few weeks ago, I send them an email and I ask them to write a letter to the upcoming players, the young players.
That's really awesome.
Talking about their pack experience and talking about their experience at Glen Allen. They send me the letters, and then I get those letters engraved on plaques, and we put them up in our dugout. So if you walk into our dugout, on the back wall, there are letters from all of these previous players. Some of them great players, some of them all-state guys, some of them were players who didn't really play that much, but they were pack guys.
Right.
And that freshman can walk in there and read those letters and instantly get an idea of what this program's about and whether I fit here or not. I want them to be excited about the fact that this is special. This is a special place to be. And if they don't feel that, if they're looking at that and say, this isn't me, I think, go play your showcase. That's fine. Okay.
Right.
I'll love you. Okay. But go play your showcase and your travel team, but you're not a fit for this program. Okay. Because that's what we're looking for.
Right.
Those kinds of guys.
Well, and that's amazing how that, you might have a dude that's more talented, maybe on paper, right? He can go play for the showcase team. He can throw his radars and play the three innings that you referenced, and then he's going to be done. May not even know how his team does. But then you get the guy who maybe isn't as talented physically or on paper, but he's a pack guy.
Right.
And that translates into championships, and that translates into building a legacy and hanging the banner in the gym and all those types of things.
Right.
And I'm with you that, you mentioned that as a high school coach, it's not the best thing to admit, but you don't even really have to play high school baseball, right?
Right.
But But what it comes down to is that guys who are a member of the pack and who buy into being a part of that pack mentality, their chances of becoming an influence in somebody else's life down the road and becoming a valuable member of society are probably much greater.
And that's why we do it. We're trying to create character guys here mm-hmm. who can, and we tell them when they get ready to leave here and they're going to go off and play. Some of our guys are fortunate enough to go play college ball. Take this with you.
Sure.
It's not just a rinky-dink high school thing. College coaches love the whole culture idea. I was just on the JMU website the other day, and Coach Eikenberry was listing the new kids that he had just recruited and were coming into the program. A little bio on each one that he, a little blurb he wrote down. And on a couple of them, he said, this kid will fit in perfectly with our culture here. College coaches also have their job on the line, so they also have to recruit talent, and sometimes they'll ignore the culture part in order to get that talented kid in. Well, not every high school program does what we do, so take this idea of the pack to the next level with you. Your
right.
college coach will love you for it,
right.
because you bring something to the table that maybe some other guys who are coming in don't. And your teammates will love you for it too, because whether they admit it or not, every young men want to be part of a tribe. They want to be part of something special, and this is something special. So take this on to the next level in college. Take this on for the rest of your life.
Sure.
Okay, this idea.
That's awesome. I'm reading a book right now. It's called, I'm such a slow reader. I think I've referenced on the past five podcasts I've done, but it's called The Last Arrow, but I'm almost done. And one of the later chapters is called Finding Your Tribe. Mm-hmm. Very similar thought process. So
right.
that's really good. A man and a former competitor, I guess, who really admires you, who was on this podcast, Coach Charlie Dragham, mm-hmm. He had a question for you. What he mentioned is that your teams have always been the most prepared, energetic, and as you said, culture-driven teams he competed against every year. He said that one of the things he always admired about you was that you never got too high or too low. He referred to it as steady Eddie. With that, Coach Charlie Dragham wanted to ask, Dave, how do you continue to stay present in the moment regardless of the craziness that's happening on the field?
I'm a great admirer of Charlie, too. I think he is the gold standard as far as baseball coaches in this area, and obviously that includes Kenny Lewis, because that's kind of he's a branch off the Kenny Lewis tree.
Sure, yeah.
And I thank Charlie for that comment. I don't know that I do. On the inside, it's not. I'm very competitive. I think to most people around me, I seem kind of laid back and cool. But on the inside, it's churning. But I also realize that if the head coach isn't calm, then the team is a reflection of what the head coach is like. And if the head coach is screaming at the umpires, if the head coach is losing it in key moments, then the team isn't going to be able to perform as best as they can. So I try to rein that in. I'm not always successful. I don't think every coach, you know, is. But I try to rein that in as much as possible. And I admire sometimes I'll be watching professional football games or baseball, and they always show the manager or the head coach. Bill Belichick never changes his expression.
Does not move.
Yes. And I wish I could do that.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, I'll get caught up in the moment, and I'll immediately rein it in, look over, and make sure that none of the guys actually saw me react to that, because I don't want them to see me reacting to that. But I think for the most part, I'm able to do that because I realize that in that moment, I'm the leader. I'm the one that they are looking to, and so I've got to be the role model.
Sure.
But it's not easy to do. It's not like it comes naturally to me.
Right.
I'm not a good loser.
So I would imagine that, you know, how do you continue to stay, the question being how do you continue to stay present in the moment, I guess what it comes down to is knowing that it's your responsibility to lead this team.
Right.
The players kind of drive you to, I guess, force yourself to stay as present in the moment as you can.
Right. And for some reason, and I don't know what it is, the bigger the game, the calmer I am.
Sure.
If I'm going to get upset, it's usually during a game that we should be winning or we're not performing well enough. That's when I'll be maybe at the end of the game, maybe angrier than
right.
I should be. Yeah.
I think you just mentioned that you hate losing.
Yes.
Which I can relate to very, very closely, whether it be sports, business, or life. I do not like it. The next question comes from Kenny Lewis, and it relates to that, and it's actually ironic that you mentioned that, because Kenny Lewis wanted to know, what do you say to your kids after a loss? And he specified to please be honest.
Well, it depends on how we played. If we lose and we competed, then I tell I have no problem with what just happened out there on the field, because we played as well. We have to give credit. Sometimes you have to tip your hat to the other team. It was a great baseball game that we just played. They outplayed us. If we didn't play up to our capabilities, then I can get upset with the guys. And I never point out individuals, but as a group, and even the players that didn't play, because we're all in this together. We are a pack.
You're a pack.
We did not elevate ourselves tonight to our standard. So I can get a little vocal about that. And it's interesting that Kenny came up with that question, because, you know, I've been coaching, this is my 40th year, and I think I've been coaching longer than Kenny, but Kenny taught me a lesson years ago. This is early 2000s, I think. We were playing Lee Davis, and of course, Kenny's teams were always competitors. And we were in the seventh or eighth inning. I think we went extra innings, and my kid gets a walk-off hit to win the game. And I go up to home plate to talk to Kenny, and I'm not, up until this point, I wasn't like this. I do not like losing. And I go up to home plate, and Kenny shakes my hand and smiles, which I can't do if I lose. And he looks at me and he says, "That was a great moment for your kid." I'm going, wow. I can't believe that the other coach is thinking about my kid, his great moment, and not upset more about the way, you know, that he lost in that moment. And Kenny doesn't even know that I learned from that moment. And he got a walk-off home run against me in a regional championship game a few years later. And when the reporters came up to me after the game, first thing I said was, "That was a great moment for that kid. He'll remember that for the rest of his life." I didn't moan and groan about the fact that we had lost the game. And that was a lesson that I learned from, and we learn from, and we steal from other coaches.
Sure.
And that was a lesson learned from Kenny. So I think Kenny taught me to temper my reactions at the end of
sure.
games, and to talk to my kids in certain ways, because Kenny's terrific at that.
Yeah, that's awesome. You had mentioned something about you didn't live up to a certain standard. When you maybe define the standard of not just the Glen Allen Jaguar baseball team, but just your standards in terms of a team, what does that standard look like? I know we have the pack mentality, but what is that standard? Because obviously, it's tough to measure it in wins and losses, right? But what is that standard?
One of the things that's included in the pack is before the season begins, once we cut down to the team, to the 20 guys, we sit down and the players come up with their core values and they come up with their standards. Their core values are their beliefs. Belief in the process, accountability towards your teammates, trust in the process, trust in your teammates, sacrifice, service. And then we come up with our standards, how you're going to act in the community, how you're going to act in school, how you're going to act on the practice field, how you're going to act during games. And then we take those standards, and we have a wall inside our dugout called the pack wall, and we place our core beliefs and our standards up on that wall so they can see them every day. So there is a set of standards, a way that we act that the kids know that if we have to reach that standard. We can't come below that standard. There's also a standard in the program. The guys know, and like I think I alluded to it earlier, there's a way to fill out this black and teal jersey, and then there's a way not to do that. It's how you act on the field, it's how you act towards umpires, it's how you act towards the opposing team. Sometimes we slip, and then we have to have a discussion about that. But there's also a standard. I mean, we put a lot of time into this, fall, winter, and spring. And so we're trying to win baseball games, okay? So we don't measure ourselves solely on wins and losses, but we're not out there to just, okay, guys, all right, we lost tonight, that's okay. We're not doing that. So there is a standard in the Glen Allen program as far as not only how you comport yourself, but also how you compete. And so that's the measurement. And they know, that, you know, we didn't reach that standard tonight, or we competed our rear ends off, and so, you know, even though we lost tonight, you know, we did the best that we could, and we let them know that as coaches.
Sure. But I think it's so incredibly important to have that written out. Here is what our standard is.
Right.
It's clarified. This is what our standard is, and I relate well to that on our little real estate team here. We have our three core beliefs, and that is our standard. Right?
Right.
So I think that's awesome that you do that with your kids. There's a question from, it's a friend of mine. His name is John Ludden, and he's actually one of the trainers at the gym where I work out every morning. He's more of a football guy, but he's listened to a couple of these. He had a very interesting question. I thought this was pretty good. John stated that it's got to be tough to be a successful baseball coach without knowing the numbers. When to bunt, pinch hit, intentional walk, steal, make tough lineup decisions, etc. Giving all of these different scenarios, and way more than the ones we just mentioned, all of these numbers, it's probably easy to overanalyze and make the wrong decision, or worse, take no action at all. What strategies or techniques do you use to prevent overthinking certain situations? Put simply, how do you avoid paralysis by analysis?
That's a good question. We're in a time in baseball now, especially at the higher levels, and it's coming down to the lower levels, where analytics is everything.
Sure.
Numbers rule everything. Data. You can see it in the major leagues with who they're hiring now. They're not necessarily hiring ex-major leaguers like they used to. They're hiring these numbers guys to crunch numbers. We don't do as much of that as at the high school level, of course, because we don't have the time. We don't have people to do that for us. So if you've been coaching as long as I have, you know, you go with your gut a lot. You've seen situations and you go with that. But for instance, with stats, there's two stats that I'm concerned with offensively. It's your hard hit percentage, how hard you hit the ball, how often. And that's an indicator to me. Batting average is the devil to me. Batting average is a lie, because you can hit 400 on the high school level and never really hit a ball hard. You can hit little dribbles, you can hit little flares, you can get hits against the weaker pitchers and build your average on that. You have a 400 average, you look like an all-state guy, but everybody on the team knows you didn't hit a ball hard all year long. So I'm interested in hard hit percentage. That tells me if you're likely in this situation to do well, to hit the ball hard. And if you're not, if I know your hard hit percentage, then maybe I am going to bunt. Maybe we are going to slash. Maybe we are going to situation hit.
Is a hard hit percentage, and I'm not as familiar with baseball, is that something that you do keep track of and
yes.
calculate? Okay, I didn't know if it was something where it's just like this guy hits the ball harder
right.
more often.
Now, again, we don't employ radar guns. We don't have hit tracks. We don't have all these analytics during the game. But I coach third base, and if somebody hits the ball, I take the lineup out of my back pocket, and I just put a little check right next to him. He may have three checks tonight. He may have gone 0-for-4, but three of the balls he hit were line drives right at somebody. He's 0-for-4, he's 0-for-8, he's 0-for-12. Coach, how come he's still playing? Well, because look at the way he hits the ball.
Sure.
Those are going to average out over the long run. He's going to wind up getting
right.
his share of hits. Well, the other guy's hitting 400, but he never hits the ball hard. He's on the bench. So hard hit percentage and what we call team at-bats. You get a bunt down, you hit behind the runner, you hit a sacrifice fly, you get a walk, you work a walk. Those things that are good for the team. And again, they may not show up in your batting average, you may not have all state stats, but you do all the little things that the team needs. So when you come up, I know your team at bat percentage, I know that you're a team. So, and by the way, you're going to be in the lineup when maybe a more talented player is on the bench, because he can't do those little things. And now you're up there, it's the seventh inning, we need to get this run into scoring position. You can hit behind the runner, I know you can put a bunt down. You're more valuable to the pack than the other guy who's kind of all or nothing. And you know, everybody, and even his parents, you know, going, hey, why isn't my kid starting? He hits better than that guy.
He's not
as valuable to the pack. And so as far as numbers, those are the numbers that I go by. Matt Dowell, who's my pitching coach, who I consider to be one of the best pitching coaches in this area, he also has his set of analytics, things that he looks for in pitchers. We try to take the old school kind of coaching, explicit training out of it, and we try to implicit coach as much as possible now, meaning the coach talks too much. Coaches have always talked too much, and we're trying to take that out of the equation and get it down to where the numbers tell us what to do in certain situations as much as possible.
To me, it sounds like in avoiding the paralysis by analysis, right? You, first of all, you break it down very simply. Mm-hmm. Do you hit the ball hard, and how often do you hit it?
Right.
I think a lot of it has to do just simply with consistency, right? And preparation. I think both of those things have a lot to do with it, as far as kind of avoiding the paralysis by analysis, for sure. That's awesome. That's a great answer. You mentioned Matt Dowell. I have a great question from him. We're going to kind of move this thing into kind of more of applying it to life and business type deal as we start to move along in this thing. Matt wanted to ask, where do you continually find the passion and the ability to reach your student athletes on and off the field, and how have you done that over time? More specifically, what's your secret to your ability to adapt and make each and every lecture and each and every practice matter to today's teenager?
All right. Good question. He used the word in the question, and without a doubt, it's all about passion. I am passionate about what I do in the classroom. I am passionate in what I do on the ball field. I've been teaching, this is my 40th year teaching, and I've had this question before, how are you not burned out? And I look at people and say, why would I be burned out? Well, you know, the kids today. I say, what about the kids today? Well, you know how they are. I say, no, tell me, how are they? I'm with them every day. Well, you know, the kids, you know, they're slack, they're this. I say, look, every day I am fortunate enough to hang out with some of the coolest people I know, and they're my students. I am constantly amazed at my students. When I was in high school, I was not academically inclined. I got decent grades, good enough to keep mom and dad satisfied and to play ball. When I went to college, I'm almost embarrassed to say this, I had the same attitude. I got good enough grades, but I didn't really care about what I was learning. Now, I'm voracious. I read like crazy. If I take a course, I have to get an A. I have to be successful in everything that I do, but I wasn't like that. So it constantly amazes me how mature these kids are. They come into my room, they're so eager to learn, they want to know, and I wasn't like that. So 40 years into this, I'm still completely, and I think that translates to them. They know that I feel that way about them, that I'm amazed by them. And the fact that I still can't believe that either baseball players or my students actually listen to me. That people actually either care about what's coming out of my mouth.
Well, I can tell you, if they listened to the past 37 minutes of our conversation, I'd listen to anything you said. I can tell you that.
But I know who I am, and I can't believe that they sit there for 90 minutes and actually soak this in. And it, like I said, my passion comes from them. How can I not be passionate when they're sitting in there wanting this education so badly?
Right.
So I have to be, in my mind, I have to be the best at what I do. 40 years into it, I could go in there and basically just do what I've always done. But every night I'm reading. I might read one more, you know, one little fact about what I'm teaching today that I didn't know. I'm reading to get me in the moment, to get me, you know, whatever it is I'm teaching today. I want to be in that moment. I want to be kind of transported. And that's what I try to do with my kids. I try to transport them for that 90 minutes to another place. If we're in the 1950s, that's where we're going today. And at the end of the 90 minutes, I want them to almost kind of, okay, now I got to go to fourth period. Okay,
right.
I want that feeling. And that's where I go. There's a light switch in me that just switches on when the class starts. And it's almost like, it's almost like I'm possessed by something else. And for those 90 minutes, I am just totally locked in with those kids. So I think the word that Matt, and it's the same thing on the baseball field, it's passion. Joe DiMaggio, years ago, somebody asked him, you know, you're Joe DiMaggio, you don't have to go out there and hustle on every play. And he looked at the interviewer and said, listen, there may be a little boy in the stands today who is seeing me play for the first time. I want him to see me hustling all the time. This may be his only exposure to me. I've taught this for 40 years, but I keep in mind that the kids who just walked in my class, this is the first time they've ever heard it. you know, this may not be exciting to me anymore, but when I look into their eyes, that's what brings out the passion, the excitement, and that's what makes me go to that place.
And I've got to imagine that what kind of continues to drive you and continues to make you passionate about the teaching and the coaching. You mentioned that you're a learner, you're reading, you're listening, all those things. You're staying up to date, and I feel like it kind of goes back to the classic, if you're not growing, you're dying, right? You got to be moving forward, and it seems like you're staying up to speed with everything and always trying to better yourself. The more that you learn, Coach Savino, the more that your students and your athletes are going to learn, for sure. That's awesome. Couple more questions before we wrap things up. Mike Morris, the man who referred me to you, he, huge admirer of you, as I'm sure you're aware. He wanted to ask this question. After coaching across four decades, how do you believe the lessons you taught have carried with your players as they have left the diamond and transitioned into their lives and their careers? And kind of going off of that, something that I wrote down was just maybe one or two specific lessons that carry the most weight outside of baseball, outside of the classroom and into life, into their career, into business.
Mm-hmm. My greatest moments are when a player, an ex-player, comes back years later and just wants to visit. They don't have to come back and say, Coach Savino, I love you, all that kind of stuff. They just, that tells me, the fact that they're coming back tells me that what we did was valuable to them. We have a VIP section at Glen Allen, and after, usually when college gets out in early May, our pack guys who have gone off to college come and stand in that VIP section, and all of our players, our young guys, see those guys who won the state championship, who did this, who did that, and they're all standing there because they're giving back by showing up, and they're telling our younger players this is valuable. Mike Morris is a perfect example. I coached Mike at Hermitage in the early 90s. Mike was a good player, but he wasn't a great player. Mike had some difficulties in his life as far as his home life was concerned. And Mike did something wrong in practice one day, and he relates this story to me.
He told me that I'm very interested to hear from your perspective.
Yeah, and he did something wrong in practice one day, and so I kept him after practice, and we did some extra running or whatever it is, a 4-3-2-1 bear crawls or whatever we were doing. And he was exhausted by it, and he was not happy with me, and I sat him down in the dugout. It was just he and I out there late at night with the lights still on, and I looked at him and I said, I know you have issues in your life, but you can't fall back on those issues and use them as an excuse, because when you graduate from here, life isn't going to care. So you have to, and I'm sympathetic and empathetic with those issues that you have, but I'm just telling you, Mike, that life is not going to care about those things when you get, and you can't use it as a crutch. So how are you going to overcome that? How are you going, and what we did today, this punishment that I gave you, this is to let you know that you're no different than the other guys on this team. Everybody's got a cross to bear. Everybody's got some kind of burden. Everybody's got something that they're dealing with. And I had no idea that impacted Mike that way. You know, Mike left the program, went on his way, and it was only when I got the Glen Allen job that Mike contacted me, said, hey, do you mind going to lunch? I said, sure. So we went to lunch. And he told me about the impact, and I had no idea that I had that kind of impact on him, and I was amazed. He's one of my assistant coaches today.
Telling you, he called me when he called me 2 weeks ago. I didn't know Mike from anybody when he mm-hmm. called me, and it was great, but he just started going on about you. And I didn't even catch his name at the beginning of the conversation. I'm like, I'm really sorry. Can you tell me your name again? You know, but the impact that you had on a guy like that, if you had half the impact on the rest of your players, you've done some amazing things. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me like the overcoming adversity, realizing that no one really cares about your excuses. Mm-hmm. Life does not care about your excuses. And being able to instill that lesson in your students and in your athletes definitely is going to carry beyond into their life, into their careers, right?
Mike would be a great guy to get on the podcast.
Yeah.
Because he has gone from, like I said, a very difficult time in his life to becoming an extremely successful businessman. And the kid, my players love him. 2 years ago in the at the end of the year awards ceremony, I asked the players to write down what they remembered from this year, and then I kind of during the awards ceremony read those off to the players. To a player, they all said the thing we love most about this year were the stories, the life lessons that Coach Morris told us. So you might want to look into him for this as well.
Trust me, he's on my short list. It'll be good. I told him I'd fulfill a promise of getting you on here. I'm going to call him back, get him on here next. Yeah. So it'll be good. All right. One of the final questions here, this is, I guess, what I refer to as the last question from the Army, comes from one of my awesome business partners. He's become a mentor of mine and a close friend, soon to be guest on the show, too. His name's Lee Sansom. He's one of my top mortgage lenders and one of the top lenders in the region, really, and he has a big background in baseball. Lee said that, "I've found that most athletes make better employees than non-athletes because they understand being competitive and understand the concept of working as a team," or maybe that pack mentality, right? So his question is, how do those qualities, specifically competitiveness and the concept of teamwork, translate into being a leader in the business world and providing for your family?
I think for the reasons that you said, if you're an athlete, you're used to adversity, you're used to overcoming adversity, you're used to working within the framework of a team, all things that translate into business. You're used to overcoming failure, and failure is key. You have to experience failure so that you can grow and you can adjust. And there's failure on the sports field, there's failure in business. Athletes know how to deal with failure and overcome it and be successful. Whereas somebody maybe who did not play sports fails and then doesn't and quits because of that failure. I think it's also, again, getting back to the idea of passion. Athletes are passionate about what, you can't go through what you go through as an athlete unless you're passionate about what you do. And once their athletic career is over, usually that passion has to be funneled into something else. And I mean, if I was running a business, I might make a point of hiring athletes because I know they're looking for somewhere to channel that passion that they had for sports into something else. They're competitive. They want to succeed. I think all of those elements go into it. And what I tell, I tell my players this, I tell my students this, find your passion. If you can find your passion and make a livelihood out of it, then that's the meaning of life. That's what's going to make you happy. If you can't make a livelihood out of it, at least keep that passion, or whatever your livelihood is, whatever your job is, make that your passion. In other words, because if you're successful at it, you're going to become passionate about it. So as far as I'm concerned, that's what makes you successful in life, being passionate about what you do.
Sure.
Whether it's on the ball field or whether it's in your job.
I couldn't agree more. All right, one final question here, and this one's from me specifically. The title, and I ask everybody this question on this podcast, the title of it, the bottom line, is all about preparation. Mm-hmm. If we put more focus and effort into the practice, you've mentioned the process, the preparation, then we do the actual game, whether that game is in sports, business, or life, success will find us along our path. Motivating others to get excited about this process can be difficult, especially when so many people are focused on the finish line. So with that said, how have you been able as a coach and a teacher to motivate your students and your athletes to buy in and act on the importance of practice, preparation, and the overall belief in the process first over the end game?
Okay. I believe motivation is internal. It comes from you. Now, as a coach, I can inspire from time to time. You can't overdo that. But I think motivation is internal. It's inside that student. It's inside that athlete. I can bring that out again with, since I'm the head coach or I'm the teacher, I'm the person all the eyeballs are on. I can bring that out with my passion. I can provide, for instance, my baseball players with a first-class facility to play at every day with the best equipment. I can learn my craft as well as I can and try to get that across to them. After that, their internal motivation has to take over. If my students or my players are relying on me every single day to provide that for them, that's not going to work. That has to come from them. I can provide the framework for them, put them in the best position, and then their internal motivation takes over at that point. And I think it's the same thing in the business world. You can provide mentors, you can provide mentorship towards your employees, a nice place to work. You can give them development courses and teach them how to do the job. But if they're not internally motivated, I mean, that's going to exhaust you if you're doing that all the time, and it's not going to mean anything to them. If if that's what they require, they're not going to remain an employee very long.
Right.
If they need you all the time to provide that for them, so motivation is tough, but that's got to be an internal thing.
Sure, absolutely. So how do you coach somebody to use that motivation, their internal motivation, to put it towards the process, the preparation before? Because it's so easy to focus on winning the game when really we need to be focused on the next at bat, right? How are you coaching your athletes up in order to believe in the process first over the finish line?
Okay. Well, specifically, what we do in baseball is make sure that the practices, everything that we do in practice is game related, and everything we do is, we call it above game speed. The game is going to be chaos. If you're in business, when you go out there and you're with a potential customer or client, things are going to happen at a speed. You may have to think on your feet real quickly. So the game is chaos. Your heartbeat gets elevated, your breathing changes, and if we don't provide situations in practice for them where their heartbeat gets elevated and their breathing changes, then if they're hitting 700 in practice, something's wrong. So practice has to be chaos. You have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable in practice.
Heard that a couple of times from you.
Yes,
baseball coaches.
Exactly. You have to be, so we have to provide, if I'm failing as a coach, if I don't provide them with that in practice, and then when the game comes, the game should be easy. Practice should, sometimes in practice, I'll overload the field. If there's nine defenders, I'll put another infielder out there. I'll put two more out. I'll put 12 guys out defensively. Turn to the hitter and say, "Now succeed." And now this hey, coach, you know, there's too many guys out there. Find a way.
Right.
Because in the ball game, seventh inning, bases loaded, two outs, and you're either, I mean, you hit the ball here hard, we win the game, or strike out, we lose. I guarantee you, with that other dugout going crazy and all those fans cheering and that guy out there on the mound getting ready to throw 90 miles an hour at you, it's chaos in that moment. So how are you going to adjust to that moment? Well, if you've done it in practice over and over again, then you there goes my heartbeat. Okay, I know how to handle this. There goes my breath. I know how to handle this. And in the game, you're able to stay quiet and get it done. And again, I'm sure it translates the same into the business world.
Absolutely.
If their training and their training is more difficult than the actual time they have with the client, then anything the client throws at them or anything that situation throws at them, they're able to handle it.
Agreed 100%. Do you, I just came up with a thought as you're going through that. Do you believe in when somebody says that somebody's a gamer, meaning that they just show up for the game, right? Because, I mean, I guess that term is used in different situations, but you hear about, you know, you're watching the NFL Combine, like, oh, he's not going to put up great numbers, but he's a gamer, right? I've always had a tough time buying into that because I think like you do, right? The practice has got to be harder than the actual game. Mm-hmm. So have you ever ran into anything like that where you're like, you've never really had maybe just a gamer. The guy's always practiced harder and the game's been easy.
Yeah. In 2014, when I got to Glen Allen, as a matter of fact, Matt Dowell told me, we got this really talented kid. He's a sophomore. You won't be impressed with him during practice, but when the lights go on and the guy says, play ball, all of a sudden, he's a gamer. And so he made the varsity as a sophomore, and he wasn't very good. And I looked at Matt like, you know, Matt, what are you talking about? This kid's not showing anything. His junior year, he was all state, and it happens, and I'm like you. I don't like the idea of you can kind of flick a switch and all of a sudden become that guy. He was one of the rare examples of that guy during practice. If a college coach came out and saw him practice, he might walk away shaking his head saying, this kid can't play D1. But if you see him in a game, all of a sudden...
Was it for lack of effort during practice?
No, it's just that he had another gear.
Sure.
And when some guys, when the pressure is on, can go to that gear. Some guys use, they're at that high gear all the time. And the problem is, it's not a very high gear.
Right.
They're great. They're good in practice. They're good in the game. This kid had somewhere else that he could go. And when the pressure was on, he could go there. And he wound up playing D1. And he's playing D1 baseball right now.
That's awesome.
And he's a terrific player. But he was one of the rare examples. Most guys, I'm with you, most guys, how you practice is how you're going to play.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. Well, Coach, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you being here. That kind of wraps up all the questions that I have for you. You have any last words, piece of advice for any of the listeners?
I think what I said earlier is the key to life is to find your passion. And if you can find, and unfortunately, a lot of people don't. I've been doing this for 40 years. I'm one of the fortunate, and I know that I'm one of the fortunate ones, that I am still passionate about what I do after all this time. Some people take 3, 4, 5 job changes before they find it. Some people never find it. But you're never going to be what we refer to as happy in life until you find that. And whatever it is, try to make it your livelihood if you can, because you spend so much time in your job. And if you can't make your livelihood, then make sure that you carve out enough time for it. So, and what if you're happy, it's going to translate to your family, it's going to translate to your coworkers and everybody around you.
Sure. Well, great piece of advice, great last words. Appreciate everything you've did for me, for this podcast, for the listeners of the show. I'm sure a lot of people get a lot of benefit out of it. So really appreciate you being here.
I appreciate you asking me.
Absolutely. Well, as always, I like to end these episodes with a challenge or a quote of some sort that applies to the lessons learned in this podcast. Today, I'll leave listeners with this quote from a motivational speaker, and I may have used this one before. He's an ex-Navy SEAL and a former world record holder for most pull-ups in 24 hours. His name is David Goggins. Goggins says that it's so easy to be great nowadays because everyone else is weak. That said, my challenge to the listeners is this. Although my hope is that we all act on motivating our average-minded teammates, associates, and friends to get off the benches of mediocrity, Goggins is correct. A lot of your competitors and a lot of your acquaintances are weak. It's your responsibility to take action to become great. Find a mentor, find your coach, and every time you take a step forward, reach your hand back and become someone else's coach, someone else's mentor. Remember, two good people coming together can become great. Thank you for listening to episode number 27 of the Bottom Line Podcast, which is now going to be titled The Pack Mentality, an interview with Coach Dave Savino. And once again, I appreciate you sharing this podcast with your average friends you think would find some benefit. Signing off, he is Coach Dave Savino. I'm your host, Ben Rogers. This is The Bottom Line, and I'll talk to you next time.